This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Tonight's program will feature the contributions and the loss, unfortunately, of two major American poets, Galway Connell and Carolyn Kaiser, both Pulitzer Prize winners, passed away in October 2014. Kaiser at the age of 89 from age-related dementia, and Connell from leukemia. He was 87 years old. I'm going to begin with Galway Connell. Born of a Scottish father and an Irish mother, both immigrants to this country, in Providence, Rhode Island in 1927, Connell's books of poetry, published between the years 1960 and 2008, focus on mortality, sex, and more. His long poem, The Avenue Bearing the Initial of Christ into the New World, published in 1960, brought some critics to compare him to Walt Whitman, a poet that he quotes frequently in his work. The poem is a poem of witness. He said more than once that he believed it is the job of poets to do just that. Quote, "To me," he said, "poetry is somebody standing up, so to speak, and saying with as little concealment as possible what it is for him or her to be on earth at this moment." Unquote. Philip Levine says in his Art of Poetry interview that Connell didn't influence him as much as he inspired him. Quote, "When I read his great poem, The Avenue Bearing the Initial of Christ into the New World, I said, my God, this is how good the poetry of my generation can be." Connell, who wrote often of New England and died in Vermont, has also been compared to Robert Frost. The poet Major Jackson did this when he said, quote, "In my mind, he comes behind that other great New England poet, Robert Frost, in his ability to write about not only the landscape of New England, but also its people. Without any great effort, it was almost as if the people and the land were one, and he acknowledged what I like to call a romantic consciousness." That was Major Jackson. So how did Connell himself speak of his own work? Well, he said he wanted to write poetry that anyone could understand, college degree or no, poems that, quote, "dwell on the ugly as fully, as far and as long as I could stomach it. I think if you are ever going to find any kind of truth to poetry, it has to be based on all of experience rather than on a narrow segment of cheerful events." Unquote. And the man did write of darkness and how to cope with that darkness as well. His collections, Body Rags, which is a book-length poem, and The Book of Nightmares are prime examples of this. It wasn't until 1983, when Connell published his selected poems, that he won the Pulitzer Prize, as well as an American Book Award. His work written after this time became a bit freer, perhaps as a result of having crossed that Pulitzer goal line. A perfect example of this writing style is in his poem Oatmeal, one of two recordings of Connell reading that I'll play for you in a little while. Unlike Kaiser, whom I had many opportunities to spend time with, I never had the chance to hear Mr. Connell read in person. But I understand that he was one of those people who could recite his work from memory, long pieces, something I've always admired since I can't do it myself, and that no one could miss him. The space he took up in a room and the energy he gave were formidable. I'm going to read a poem of Connell's called The Deconstruction of Emily Dickinson. This reminds me of his statement about wanting people to understand his work even without a college education. This poem was published in his book Imperfect Thirst, which was published by Houghton Mifflin in 1994. And following that, I'm going to read the third section of a 5-section poem called The Striped Snake and the Goldfinch. And this poem appears in that same book. After that, I'm going to play a couple of recordings of Cannell reading his own work. But first, here are two poems by Galway Cannell, beginning with The Deconstruction of Emily Dickinson. The lecture had ended when I came in, and the professor was answering questions. I do not know what he had been doing with her poetry, but now he was speaking of her as a victim of reluctant male publishers. When the questions dwindled, I put up my hand. I said the ignorant meddling of the Springfield Daily Republican, and the hidebound response of literary men, and the gulf between the poetic wishfulness then admired and her own harsh knowledge, had let her see that her poems would not be understood in her time. And therefore, passionate to publish, she vowed not to publish again. I said I would recite a version of her vow. Publication is the auction of the mind of man. But before I could, the professor broke in. Yes, he said, the auction, auction from auger, auctum, to augment, to author. Let's hear the poem, several women who at such a moment are more outspoken than men shouted. But I kept still, and he kept going. In octum, the economy of the signifier is split, revealing an unconscious collusion in the bourgeois commodification of consciousness, while our author says no, the unrarefied text says yes, yes. He kissed his lips together and turned to me, saying, Now may we hear the poem? I waited a moment for full effect. Without raising to my feet, I said, Professor, to understand Dickinson, it may not always be necessary to uproot her words. Why not first try listening to her? Loyalty forbids me to recite her poem now. No, I didn't say that. I realized she would want me to finish him off with one wallop. So I said, Professor, I thought you would welcome the words of your author. I see you prefer to hear yourself speak. No, I held back, for I could hear her urging me to put outrage into my voice and substance into my argument. I stood up so that everyone might see the derision in my smile. Professor, I said, you live in Amherst at the end of the 20th century. For you, auction means a quaint event where somebody coaxes out the bids on butter churns on a summer Saturday. Forget etymology. This is history. In Amherst in 1860, auction meant the slave auction, you dope. Well, I didn't say that either, although I have said them all many times in the middle of the night. In reality, I stood up and recited the poem like a schoolboy called upon in class. My voice gradually weakened, and the women who had called out for the poem now looked as though they were thinking of errands to be done on the way home. When I finished, the professor smiled. Thank you. So, what at first some of us may have taken as a simple outcry, we all now see as an ambivalent, self-subversive text. As people got up to go, I moved into the sanctum within me where Emily sometimes speaks a verse and listened for a sign of how she felt, such as, Thanks, sweet countryman, for wanting to sing out of me after all that humbug. But she was silent. And now I'm going to read the third section of his poem, The Striped Snake and the Goldfinch. How much do I have left of the loyalty to earth, which human shame and dislike of our own lives and others' deaths that take part of us with them wear out of us as we go toward that moment when we find out how we die, clinging and pleading, or secretly relieved that it is all over, or despising ourselves, knowing that death is a punishment we deserve, or, like an old dog off his feed, who suddenly is ravenous and eats the bowl clean, and the next day is a carcass. There is an unfillableness in us, in some of us, a longing for that blue-shaded black night where the beloved dead and all those others who suffered and sang and were not defeated, the one who hushed them by singing Going Home when they lynched him on Bald Mountain, the klezmer violinists who pressed bows across strings until eyes, by near starvation, enlarged, grew wet and sparkled, have gone. Yet I know more than ever that here is the true place, here where we sit together out of the wind with a loaf of country bread and tomatoes still warm from the distant sun, and wine in glasses that are one for each of us, the upper bell of the glass that will hold the last hour we have to live. Now, here are two poems read by Galway Kinnell himself, Oatmeal, and After Making Love, We Hear Footsteps.
Oatmeal. I eat oatmeal for breakfast. I make it on the hot plate and put skimmed milk on it. I eat it alone. I am aware it is not good to eat oatmeal alone. Its consistency is such that it is better for your mental health if somebody eats it with you. That is why I often think up an imaginary companion to have breakfast with. Possibly it is even worse to eat oatmeal with an imaginary companion. Nevertheless, yesterday morning I ate my oatmeal with John Keats. Keats said that due to its glutinous texture, gluey lumpishness, hint of slime, and unusual willingness to disintegrate, oatmeal must never be eaten alone. He said it's perfectly okay to eat it with an imaginary companion, and he himself had enjoyed memorable porridges with Edmund Spenser and John Milton. He also told me about writing the Ode to a Nightingale. He wrote it quickly, he said, on scraps of paper, which he then stuck in his pocket. But when he got home, he couldn't figure out the order of the stanzas. And he and a friend spread the papers on a table, and they made some sense of them, but he isn't sure to this day if they got it right. An entire stanza may have slipped into the lining of his jacket. He still wonders about the occasional sense of drift between stanzas, and the way here and there a line will go into the configuration of a Muslimate prayer, then raise itself up and peer about, then lay itself down slightly off the mark, causing the poem to move forward with God's reckless wobble. He said, someone told him that later in life, Wordsworth heard about the scraps of paper on the table and tried shuffling some stanzas of his own, but only made matters worse. When breakfast was over, John recited To Autumn. He recited it slowly, with much feeling, and his odd accent sounded sweet. He didn't offer the story of writing it. I doubted there is much of one, but he did say the sight of a just-harvested oat field got him started on it. And two of the lines, For summer has o'er-brimmed their clammy cells, and Thou watchest the last oozings hours by hours, came to him while eating oatmeal alone. I can see him drawing a spoon through the stuff, gazing into the glimmering furrows, muttering, and it occurs to me, maybe there is no sublime, only the shining of the amnion's tatters. For supper tonight, I'm going to have a baked potato left over from lunch. No doubt it will be damp, slippery, and simultaneously gummy and crumbly, and therefore I'm going to invite Patrick Kavanaugh to join me.
After Making Love, We Hear Footsteps. For I can snore like a bullhorn, or play loud music, or sit up talking with any reasonably sober Irishman, and Fergus will only sink deeper into his dreamless sleep, which goes by all in one flash. But let there be that heavy breathing, or a stifled come cry anywhere in the house, and he will wrench himself awake and make for it on the run. As now, we lie together, after making love, quiet, touching down the length of our bodies, familiar touch of the long married, and he appears, in his baseball pajamas, it happens, the neck opening so small he has to screw them on, and flops down between us, and hugs us, and snuggles himself to sleep, his face gleaming with satisfaction at being this very child. In the half-darkness, we look at each other and smile and touch arms across this little startlingly muscled body, this one whom habit of memory propels to the ground of his making. Sleeper, only the mortal sounds can sing awake. This blessing love gives again into our arms.
So those were two poems, two very different poems, read by Galway Kinnell. And I'm actually going to play a third poem now. This shows the man as more of a political being. He did write some political poems. This poem is an excerpt, or what I'm going to play next is an excerpt from a longer poem called Vapor Trail Reflected in a Frog Pond. And it was recorded at the original read-in for Peace in Vietnam and is on an album by the same name. So here now is an excerpt from Vapor Trail Reflected in a Frog Pond, written and read by Galway Kinnell.
And I hear, coming over the hills, America singing. Her varied carols I hear. Crack of deputies' rifles practicing their aim on stray dogs at night. Sput of cattle prod touching the flesh of a girl. Landlord belching roast rat. General napkinning his lips after downing his dinner of cloudy black flesh of the poor. And I hear the TV, between its little shows of killing, chanting disgust at the smells of the human body. And I hear a soldier, perhaps himself only a victim, cursing as he stands in Asia, poisoning, burning, grinding, and stabbing the eternal rice of the world. I know there are brave, blithe, passionate men and women who love their lives, who care about and respect the lives of those who share with them this strange world. But now I hear this soldier machine-gunning the rice, cursing with open mouth, insane, body-hating curses. Yes, somewhere on earth, bones wearing a few shadows walk down a road in the back country, smashed bloodsuckers on their heels, knowing the flesh a man throws down in the sunshine dogs shall eat, and the flesh he upthrows in the air shall be seized by birds.
This will conclude tonight's portion on Galway Kinnell. Galway Kinnell, the poet, was born on February 1st, 1927, and died October 28th, 2014. We're going to move on now to the next segment of the program, which will focus on Carolyn Kaiser, who died, who also died in October of 2014. I'm going to play a couple of selections from previous programs that I have aired on Carolyn Kaiser. The first one was recorded on International Women's Day some years back, It was in, let's see, it was in March of 2007. So here is the first excerpt from a program with Carolyn Kaiser. This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. International Women's Day, first celebrated in 1911, falls on March 8th each year, and each year a different theme for the day is declared by the United Nations. This year, 2014, the theme is Inspiring Change. On March 8th, 2007, the theme was Ending Impunity for Violence Against Women and Girls. Locally, the day was celebrated at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts with a reading by, among others, Carolyn Kaiser. A Pacific Northwest poet residing in Sonoma, Kaiser is a Pulitzer Prize in Poetry winner. She was the first director of the literary program at the National Endowment for the Arts, a member of the board of the Academy of American Poets, and has been a poet in residence at Columbia, Stanford, and Princeton, among others. Her last book published is Cool, Calm, and Collected, Poems 1960 to 2000, and was published by Copper Canyon in 2001. In my opinion, this book is a must-have. In part because Kaiser is no longer giving public readings, I'm extremely happy that I recorded her reading on International Women's Day in 2007. From Sappho to myself, Kaiser says in her poem, Pro Femina, consider the fate of women. Here is Carolyn Kaiser.
I'm going to read from Pro Femina because today is International Women's Day, and that seems appropriate. From Sappho to myself, consider the fate of women. How unwomanly to discuss it. Like a noose or an albatross necktie, the clinical sobriquet hangs us, codpiece coveters. Never mind these epithets. I myself have collected some honeys. Juvenal set us apart in denouncing our vices, which had grown in part from having been set apart. Women abused their spouses, cuckolded them, even plotted to poison them. Sensing behind the violence of his manner, think I'm crazy or drunk, his emotional stake in us, as we forgive Strindberg and Nietzsche, we forgive all those who cannot forget us. We are hyenas, we admit it. While men have politely debated free will, we have howled for it. Howl still, pacing the centuries, tragedy heroines. Some who sat quietly in the corner with their embroidery were Defarges, dabbing the wool with their names of their ancient oppressors who ruled by the divine right of the male. Oh, I'm impatient of interruptions. I'm aware there were millions of mutes for every Saint Joan or Sainted Jane Austen who, vague-eyed and acquiescent, worshipped God as a man. I'm not concerned with these cabbage heads, not truly feminine, but neutered by labor. I mean, real women like you and like me. Freed in fact, not in custom, lifted from furrow and scullery, not obliged now to be the pot for the annual chicken. Have we begun to arrive in time? With our well-known respect for life, because it hurts so much to come out with it. Disdainful of sovereignty, national honor, and other abstractions. We can say, like the ancient Chinese to successive waves of invaders, relax and let us absorb you. You can learn temperance in a more temperate climate. Give us just a few decades of grace to encourage the fine art of acquiescence, and we might save the race. Meanwhile, observe our creative chaos, flux, efflorescence, whatever you care to call it. I take as my theme the independent woman. Independent but maimed. Observe the exigent neckties choking violet writers, the sad slacks of stipple-faced matrons, indigo intellectuals, crop-haired and callous-toed. Cute spectacles, chewed cuticles, aced out by full-time beauties in the race for the male. Returning to drabness, bad manners, and sleeping with manuscript. Forgive our transgressions of old gallantries as we hitch in chairs, light our own cigarettes, not expecting your care, having forfeited it by trying to get even. But we need dependency, cosseting, and well-treatment. So do men sometimes. Why don't they admit it? We will be cows for a while, because babies howl for us. Be kittens or bitches who want to eat grass now and then for the sake of our health. But the role of pastoral heroine is not permanent, Jack. We want to get back to the meeting. Knitting booties and brows, tartars or termagants, ancient fertility symbols chained to our cycle, released only in part by devices of hygiene and personal daintiness. Strapped into our girdles, held down, uplifted by man's ingenious constructions, holding coiffures in a breeze, hobbled and swathed in whimsy, tripping on feminine shoes with fool heels, losing our slippers, you, me, in ephemeral stockings, clutching our handbags and packages. Our masks, always in peril of smearing or cracking, in need of continuous check in the mirror or silverware, keep us enthralled to ourselves, concerned with our surfaces. Look at man's uniform drabness, his impersonal envelope over chicken wrists or meat shoulders, a formal, hard-fibered assurance. The drape of the male is designed to achieve self-forgetfulness. So, sister, forget yourself a few times and see where it gets you. Up the creek, alone with your talent, sans everything else. You can wait for the menopause and catch up on your reef. So prim, preen, prick, pluck, and prize your flesh, all polish, all ravishment, all sensibility. Meanwhile, have you used your mind today? What pomegranate raised you from the dead, sprung full grown from your own head, Athena? Now, well, how much time do I have now?
Oh, keep going. Hmm? 5 minutes.
Shall I read another section?
Yeah.
All right. I will speak about women of letters, for I'm in the racket. Our biggest successes to date, old maids to a woman. And our saddest conspicuous failures, the married spinsters on loan to the husbands they treated like surrogate fathers. Think of that crew of self-pitiers, not very distant, who carried the torch for themselves and got first-degree burns. Or the sad sonneteers, Toast and Teasdales, we loved at 13. Middle-aged virgins seducing the puerile anthologists through lust of the mind. Barbiturate-wrenched Camilles with continuous periods murmuring softly on sofas. When poetry wasn't a craft but a sickly effluvium, the air thick with incense, musk, and emotional blackmail. I suppose they reacted from an earlier womanly modesty when too many girls were scabs to their stricken sisterhood, impugning our sex to stay in good with the men, commencing their insecure bluster. How they must have swaggered when women themselves endorsed their own inferiority. Vestals, vassals, and vessels rolled into several. They took notes in rolling syllabics in careful journals, aiming to please a posterity that despises them. But we'll always have traitors who swear that a woman surrenders her supreme function by equating art with aggression and failure with femininity.
You're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM.
Still, it's just as unfair to equate art with femininity like a prettily packaged commodity when we aren't the custodians of the world's best-kept secret, merely the private lives of one half of humanity. But even with masculine dominance, we mayors and mistresses produced some sleek saboteurs, making their cracks, which porridge-brained males of the day were too thick to perceive, mistaking young hornets for perfectly harmless bumblebees, Being thought innocent, innocuous, rouses some women to frenzy. They try to be ugly by aping the ways of the men and succeed. Swearing, sucking cigars and scorching the bedspread, slopping straight shots, eyes bloated, blotted, vanity bone in the expectation of glory, she writes like a man. This drives other women mad in a mist of chiffon. One poetess draped her gauze over red flannels, a practical feminist. But we're emerging from all that more or less, except for some ladylike laggards and quarterly priestesses who flog men for fun and kick women to BAME competition. Now, if we struggle abnormally, we may almost seem normal. If we submerge our self-pity in disciplined industry, if we stand up to be hated and swear not to sleep with editors, if we regard ourselves formally, respecting our true limitations, without making an unseemly show of trying to unfreeze our assets, keeping our heads and our pride while remaining unmarried, and if wedded, feel guilt in its tracks when we stack up the dishes and defect to the typewriter, and if mothers believe in the luck of our children, whom we forbid to devour us, whom we shall not devour, and the luck of our husbands and lovers who keep free women. Well, I guess I'll read part of Fanny. At Samoa, hardly unpacked, I commenced planting. When I'd opened the chicken crates, built the coach and the coop, the Reverend Mr. Claxett came to call, found me covered with mud, my clothes torn, my hair in a wad, my bare feet bleeding. I had started the buffalo grass in the new-made clearing. The next day, the priest paid a visit, civil but restless. I was dying to plant the alfalfa seed. He gave him a packet. That evening, I paced up and down, dropping melon seeds, tomato, and bush lima beans here and there, where I thought they would grow. We were short of food now, so I cooked up a mess of fine little parrots, disturbed all the way they suggested, cages and swings and stands. An excellent meal. I've been told the dodo survived here and yearned for a pet on the string, and I built the pig house. I had bought sweet coconut seed from Savage Island. I planted kidney potatoes in small earthen hills, sowed seeds of eggplant in numerous boxes of soil, tomato and artichoke, too. Half a dozen fine pineapple sent over by Mr. Carruthers, the island solicitor. As fast as we eat them, we plant the tops. The kitchen, a shack near the house. I make bread in the rain. Louis has called me a peasant. How I brooded, confided it to you, diary, then crossed it out, peasant, because I delve in the earth I own, confiding my seed and root, I too a creator. My heart melts over a bed of young peas. A blossom on the rose tree is like a poem by my son. My hurt healed by its cause, I go on planting. I'm skipping quite a bit here. It hurts, his remark, that I have the soul of a peasant. My vanity, like a newly felled tree, lies prone and bleeding. I clear the weeds near the house for planting maize. Sweet corn and peas are showing. I send for more seeds. I clean out the potatoes which had rotted in their hills. Of course, RLS is not idle. He is writing a footnote to history. How the great powers combine to carve up these islands. The garden looks like a graveyard, beds shaped like tombs. I plant cabbage, which I loathe, so the British won't tease me for not growing it. But behold, in the hedge, among citron and lime, many lemon trees in full bearing. Still, I will fall to brooding before the mirror, though Louis says he finds the peasant class interesting. He is 40 today. I am 10 years his senior. Sometimes when planting, a strange subterranean rumble, volcanic, vexes the earth beneath this peasant haunch. I rise up from my furrow, Knuckles smooth my brow as I sniff the air, suddenly chemical, a sulfurous fume. Louis insisted on going to Sydney, fell ill again. His mother comes back with him, finds me on my knees. The old lady's heart leaps. Alas, I am planting. I'm skipping quite a bit here. Planted coffee all day and breadfruit, five beauties. Planted coffee the better part of the day, eight plants in the nursery, three that times as many. Planted coffee, painted the storm shutters, planted coffee all morning. I found a heap of old bones in a bush near the sty. Two heads and a body, a warrior dead with his prize. Louis gave the bones a funeral and a burial. A series of hurricanes, Louis wrote to the Times of the foul colonial politics. I send in to New York for seeds, Southern Cross cabbage, eggplant, sweet potato, and 2,000 custard apples. Louis's own seed, David Balfour, is growing. I wrote nothing from June till the end of this year. Too busy planting. The Samoan princes are getting ready to war. It pains me to write this. My son-in-law has gone native in a spectacular way. Belle is divorcing him. Austin, my grandson, is in school in Monterey. I have not, I believe, mentioned Mrs. Stevenson lately. She has gone back to Scotland. The first breadfruit boar, Belle and I go on sketching expeditions to the hostile Samoan camps, stop in town for ginger beer. Mr. Haggard begged us to stay in town because he bitterly wanted women to protect. I suggested to him that I and my daughter could hide under his table and hand him cartridges at the window to complete the romantic effect. It is clear that Mr. Haggard is Ryder's brother. He said, "You'd sell your life for a bunch of banana trees." I'd given permission to most of the boys to go to the races. Lloyd has put up the lawn tennis things. Mr. Gurr, the neighbor, rushes in to say war has begun. We all race the mission. 11 heads have been taken. Later, Mr. Dine's cousin received a head smeared with black. The custom is to return them to the bereaved. He washed it off and discovered it was his brother. He sat there holding his brother's head in his hands, kissing it, bathing it with his tears. A scandal arose because the heads of three girls have been taken as well, unheard of before in Sonoma, returned wrapped in silk to their kin. At Mali, warriors danced a headhunter's pantomime. The men who had taken heads carried great lumps of raw pork between their teeth, cut in the semblance of heads. I stopped writing this, too hysterical with migraine. Also, people find out where I hide it and strike things out. Our favorite chef is exiled for life. The war winds down. Louis works on his masterpiece, The Weir of Hermiston. Well, I've kept him alive for 8 more years, while his dear friends would have condemned him to fog and rain, so they might enjoy his glorious talk in London, though it be the end of him. Fine friends. Except for James. Later, at 6, Louis helped with mayonnaise when he put both hands to his head and said, "Oh, what a pain. Do I look strange?" I said no, not wanting to frighten him. He was never conscious again. In 2 hours, he died. Tonight, the chiefs with their axes are digging a path to the top of the mountain. They will dig his grave. I will leave here as soon as I can and never return, except to be buried beside him. I will live like a gypsy in my wild, ragged clothes until I am old, old. I will have pretty gardens wherever I am, but never breadfruit, custard apple, grenadilla, cacao, pineapple, yang-yang, citron, mango, cow. Never again come to the fever of planting. All right, that's it.
And now for the last segment on this program concerning Carolyn Kaiser, I'm going to play a portion of a program that I aired just in April of 2014, following a visit to Carolyn Kaiser with the poet Annie Finch and Joyce Jenkins, the editor of Poetry Flash. Tonight's program features an essay written by Annie Finch about our visit with the poet Carolyn Kaiser last fall. In October of 2013, I heard from Maine poet Annie Finch that she was in the San Francisco Bay Area. She expressed an interest in visiting the poet Carolyn Kaiser, to whom she has a very special connection, but didn't know how to reach her. Joyce Jenkins, the untiring editor of Poetry Flash, also wanted to visit Kaiser. As a result, I contacted the care home where Kaiser is residing and arranged for the three of us to meet her there on Wednesday, October 23rd. The visit was intensely moving. I'm certain that all three of us wrote about it as soon as we were able. I know I did. But Finch, who read her poem, A Carol for Carolyn, on this program recently, has published an essay about the visit on the website for the Poetry Foundation. If you're not familiar with the foundation, I encourage you to visit poetryfoundation.org. When I read Finch's essay, I was moved again to tears. Happily, both she and the foundation have given me permission to read this essay on the air. Here is Annie Finch's remembrance of our visit. Visiting Carolyn Kaiser. Mentorship from a woman poet is no small thing. It is easy to be a poet, brim with transparent water. Carolyn Kaiser's book, Mermaids in the Basement, was open on the table before me, but I recited the lines from memory as I scanned the familiar yet strange face so close to mine for any sign that their author recognized them in all their bravura and beauty. The beloved words rose up through my voice, then spread out through the small room. Kaiser's sharp gray eyes focused, glittered, and then radiant recognition came. A bigger, sweeter smile than any I'd ever seen her bestow in the 25 years I'd known her broke loose across her face. She looked suddenly youthful, and all of us were charmed, repaid, transported in the echo of the words of her poem, in the eloquent silence of that smile. We had come, three women poets, Catherine Hastings, host of the Word Temple Poetry Program on Sonoma County's KRCB-FM, Joyce Jenkins, editor of the Bay Area's Poetry Flash, and I, on a reading tour for my selected poems, Spells, from my home in Maine, to pay tribute to the one of the last of a generation. Born into the same generation of Plath, Sexton, Cumin, Clifton, Rich, Lord, Levertov, and Brooks, Carolyn Kaiser has been one of the most manifestly feminist of that breakthrough wave of women poets. A native of Spokane, Washington, she enrolled in Theodore Rettke's poetry class at the University of Washington in 1954 as a recently divorced 29-year-old mother of three young children. She went on to become a founding editor of Poetry Northwest, editor of such anthologies as 100 Great Poems by Women and The Essential John Clare, the first director of literary programs for the NEA, and author during the 1970s and beyond of 8 books of poetry, including the powerful and classic poems Pro Femina, Bitch, Semele Recycled, and A Muse of Water. Her brilliant book, Yin, New Poems, turned down by just about every major poetry publishing house, was finally picked up by the small press BOA Editions and then awarded, adding an everlasting tale to the store of poets' consolations, the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry in 1984. Like so many other women who knew Carolyn, each of us three that day felt indebted to her in complex and poignant ways. Each of us had found her not only a literary inspiration and role model, but also a supportive mentor, Kaiser, after meeting me briefly once and reading the manuscript that I had sent at her encouragement, had offered to write a review of my first book of poetry. She had also urged me to visit her friend Marie Ponsot in New York, telling me, "Go with your book tucked under your arm." She would send Christmas cards, one consisting of a hilarious poem with the refrain, "Major poets don't send Christmas cards." This was precious to me, I think, because I understood a gendered subtext. Male major poets don't usually seem to send Christmas cards, Frost, Wilbur, and Heaney being three notable exceptions, but Carolyn was pulling it off. Mentorship like that from a woman poet was no small thing, especially in the late 20th century. No wonder Joyce, Catherine, and I, all born in the 1950s, treasured our relationship with Carolyn. We had experienced firsthand how singular such a gift was. Maxine Cumin, an exact contemporary of Kaiser's, for example, once told me that the only women poets she mentors are older than she is, women who are even less comfortable than she is in navigating the male-dominated literary world. And Ariel Greenberg and Rachel Zucker include among the mentees in their anthology Women Poets on Mentorship, only women poets born after 1960, because, according to their preface, most women poets born before that were mentored by men, if we were mentored at all. After all, it is only recently that most women have felt themselves in a position powerful enough to mentor anyone. And many of us, even now, have yet to really learn how. If you haven't had the experience of being mentored yourself, it is that much harder to get the hang of it. But Kaiser was the exception. As I drove my rental car north over the Golden Gate Bridge toward Sonoma, Joyce Jenkins shared with me her own tales of Kaiser's generosity. She had encouraged Joyce to publish her first collection of poems and had written a preface for the book. She had donated items to auctions benefiting Poetry Flash and lent her queenly presence to many small readings given by local poets in the Flash's poetry series. As I listened to Joyce, it became clear to me that she had been moved by Carolyn's rare generosity in the same way I had been. I had first promised myself to visit Carolyn during a conversation with Joyce several years earlier, during a literary conference. Joyce told me that Carolyn, then in her mid-80s and suffering from dementia, had been moved out of the house she shared with her architect husband and into an assisted living facility. During the same conversation, Joyce happened to mention that Carolyn had donated several belly dance costumes collected while she was serving as cultural ambassador to Pakistan to an auction to benefit Poetry Flash. Well, that did it. Having an older sister who was once a professional belly dancer, I happen to have a personal relationship with this magnificent art form. Kaiser is the only woman poet of her generation whom I could imagine having belly dance costumes and the audacity to donate them. I was reminded how fiercely I loved this courageous and vivacious woman, the most explicitly sensual woman poet of her generation. So when a reading invitation brought me out west, Joyce and I arranged to drive up to Sonoma to pay our respects. Joyce got in touch with Catherine, who lived in the same county, and she agreed to meet us there. All seemed to be falling into place. But halfway through the drive, just as we were entering the drought-parched brown hills of Sonoma County, we got a phone call from Catherine, who had already arrived. "Carolyn has taken a turn for the worse," she told Joyce. "She may not even recognize you at all. Are you both sure you want to go?" I looked at Joyce, and we were both quiet for a moment, remembering Carolyn in her prime. The jewels, the hair, the fur, the acerbic wit. Did we want to see her old and vulnerable? Joyce looked back at me. I knew she was thinking the way I was. "We're coming anyway," we told Catherine. There was no question about it. We needed this pilgrimage for Carolyn's sake and for our own. For centuries, the relationship of women poets with our poetic forebears has been fraught. Eager to be embraced by the powerful male poetry establishment, women have turned their backs on the women who came before them, disowning their female poetic ancestors as quaint or trivial. As Sandra Gilbert and Susan Gubar point out in their landmark 1985 essay, Forward into the Past, the price of success as a woman poet for centuries was to disown one's literary femininity. If this is still largely true, it was far truer in Kaiser's generation. Kaiser was a magnificent exception. She was never afraid to champion women's poetics and to stand by other women poets. As we drove up to the modest Southwestern-style building, a small group assisted living facility on a quiet cul-de-sac, I felt quiet, anxious, alone. If you had asked me as I entered the building what the purpose of this pilgrimage was, after all, I couldn't have said. I just wanted to see her, that was all. My education had exposed me to many stories of aged male poets at the ends of their lives, blind Milton on his deathbed, dictating poetry to his daughters, Goethe crying, "More light," Whitman with his white beard in Camden, New Jersey, receiving pilgrimages from young poets, Joyce with a young Beckett offering his assistance, Pound in St. Elizabeth's, and elder Hayden Carruth in his cottage in Vermont. But the tales of aged female poets are much fewer, even if they avoided death in childbirth or death by disease, alcohol, or suicide, and survived into old age. They seem to fade into private life with no literary tales wrapped around their legends. So I had no preconceptions about our meeting today, no sense of being part of a tradition or a chain. The three of us walked into the building. Carolyn was brought out to see us in a wheelchair, and I was flooded with how strange it was, how much love I felt for her still, and how bright her smile was. Then, in spite of what we had been warned, it occurred to me that I did feel that she recognized me, and I think Joyce and Catherine also felt recognized. We sat around a table together. We told her how glad we were to see her, how far we had traveled, how important she was to us, how often we had thought of her, and how much her poetry is still admired. She simply smiled back at us. I think we were all captivated by the sweet brilliance of her smile, an open smile almost like a child's, so different from any expression of the wry, witty, and brittle Carolyn we had known before. After a while, something became clear to all of us, and we could no longer avoid acknowledging it. Carolyn was not talking at all. Though her smile, changing and sensitive, alive with knowledge and recognition, was eloquent, she was not speaking any words. After a while longer, I got the idea to read her some poems. That morning, Joyce had given me a tour of the Poetry Flash office, stuffed with poetry memorabilia, and a library covering many walls, floor to ceiling. On a whim, we had pulled the Flash's complete Kaiser collection, about a foot and a half of poetry, off the shelf to bring along, thinking Carolyn might enjoy seeing the books. They were piled on the table, and I had also brought Carolyn a copy of my own new book, Spells. So I started with my poem, A Carol for Carolyn, which I had written in tribute to her for a panel at an AWP conference. Quote, "She brims with transparent water, as mother and poet and daughter," unquote. Then I opened the Flash's copy of the 2000 reprint of Pro Femina and read out the beginning. "I will speak about women of letters, for I'm in the racket. Our biggest successes to date? Old maids to a woman. And our saddest conspicuous failures? The married spinsters, on loan to the husbands they treated like surrogate fathers. Think of that crew of self-pitiers, not very distant, who carried the torch for themselves and got first-degree burns. Or the sad sonneteers, Toast and Teasdales we loved at 13, middle-aged virgins seducing the puerile anthologists, through lust of the mind, barbiturate-drenched Camilles, with continuous periods murmuring softly on sofas, when poetry wasn't a craft but a sickly effluvium, the air thick with incense, musk, and emotional blackmail. Did Carolyn recognize her own poem? Her face lit up, and it seemed apparent that she was following every word, nodding proudly at particularly good moments, laughing with her eyes at the funniest parts. Then Joyce and Catherine shared some of their favorite Kaiser poems, reading so beautifully that time stopped, and I read another. We passed the books around the table for a good long while, gifting the poet's poems back to her. The last one I remember reading was this passage from A Muse of Water. We rose in mists and died in clouds, or sank below the trammeled soil, to silent conduits underground, joining the blind fish and the mole. A gleam of silver in the shale, lost murmur, subterranean moan. So flows in dark caves, dries away, what would have brimmed from bank to bank, kissing the fields you turned to stone, under the boughs your axes broke. And so our visit passed, an afternoon out of time. About 90 minutes after we had arrived, the spell finally broke when Carolyn's son arrived for a visit. We spoke with him about the possibility of getting Carolyn a desk and computer in case she wanted to do some writing, and hatched a plan to record some of her own poems and perhaps other favorites so she could listen to them. Through all of this conversation, Carolyn watched with the same keen attention, and through all this time, she never spoke. Finally, there was nothing more for us to say. It was time to go. We hugged Carolyn Kaiser goodbye. We told her again how much we admired her, appreciated her, loved her, and how much her poems mean to so many people. Catherine, who lives nearby, promised to visit her again soon, and reluctantly, we started to make our way toward the door. At that moment, as I gave Carolyn my last hug, it happened. In a voice I will never forget. She looked right into my eyes, and she spoke. And then she repeated the same words to the others. They were her last words to each of us, to all of us. "Thank you," she said. This is Catherine Hastings, and I've been reading an essay written by the Maine poet Annie Finch, Visiting Carolyn Kaiser, Mentorship from a Woman Poet is No Small Thing. This was published on poetryfoundation.org. You can find the article by going there. And this is Catherine Hastings, and we are back in the present moment now. I just played some older recordings of programs where I featured Carolyn Kaiser. It was just time to do it again since this great woman passed on. Tonight's program featured works by Galway Connell, who also passed away in October of 2014, as well as Carolyn Kaiser. And I hope you will look up both of these poets. They're very different from each other. They have different things to offer. And I hope you enjoyed tonight's program. If you have any questions or comments, please do contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.